Major Highfield, Reel 8. Now, just to pick up on, there's two officers here, prominent officers, we haven't really discussed yet, and I'd like to just get a bit about what they were like so people can have a picture of them.
Right.
And these are both Major Bill Cheeseman, I presume he's a major, and Major Collett White, who was by then a colonel from the side, or at least an honorary colonel, you know, by promotion. What were these two characters like?
Well, Bill Cheeseman was the battery captain of 293 Battery when I first joined the regiment in February 1940, having been a long-serving territorial officer. And he had, in fact, been given the 3rd Battery when we reformed in the Gazala line. And this was really a distinction for him.
What was he like?
As a territorial officer. He was a very caring man, attention to detail, a quiet man, but very, very good officer indeed, of long service with the TA.
Was he friendly, or, you know, as a person?
Oh, yes, yes.
He made you welcome. And Major Collett White, what was he like?
Major Collett White was a regular officer who had come and joined the regiment when it was in Dorset and had commanded 296 Battery. Later, when after Iraq, he was called in to be the second in command, and now when I saw him for the first time, he had been made colonel because Colonel Dewing had moved on to other duties.
Now, what was he like as colonel?
His initials were HE, which stands for high explosive. He was very tall, very good looking, and very competent. A typical, long-serving, regular gunner officer.
How long were you at Mena?
Only a matter of days. Suddenly, the Rommel decided to probe our lines and at the end of August, and we were called to action straight away. This, in fact, was the only time we didn't work with the division. It was to support an armoured brigade which was being called forward. We moved forward in the dark on the Alexandra Road, then on tracks, and dug in a very rocky ground position. The next day, the order was given to go further forward, and we did this, and then went into action on the on a sandier position, and in which we could, in fact, see in the distance the tanks of 15th Panzer Division at several miles. This was where Rommel's probing attack had reached. There were some large hillocks nearby, and we were supporting an armoured unit which was to join up with the 22nd Armoured Brigade, which was on the ridge at Alam Halfa.
So that was the armoured brigade you were meant to be supporting, the 22nd Armoured Brigade?
No, it was a regiment that was to join them, to link up so that they couldn't be outflanked.
And which regiment was it?
They had come from Palestine, they'd not been in action before, and they lost about 5 tanks in effecting the junction. But 22nd Armoured Brigade by this time had beaten off the main attack which had been launched on them and were holding their ground. This action took place over about 3 or 4 days, and one of the contributing factors was the air. Suddenly, overhead, the formations of 18 medium bombers moved over to relatively low height to bomb the advanced troops, which were mainly 15th Panzer Division. And this action was very reassuring. I think we realised that for the first time in the war, the balance of air power was changing, having previously been always, or nearly always, against us. Rommel stuck, held his positions for another couple of days, two or three days, but then decided to make a slow withdrawal, and this was done. And we then moved forward to take over further positions, and in fact waited for the moment when 50th Division Infantry, who were reforming, could be brought forward to take out their position in the Alamein line.
So whereabouts were you put in the Alamein line?
Well, the division had suffered very severe casualties in the Battle of Gazala and the retreat, which we had lost a battery, and the infantry had to fight at Alamein itself, and it took some time to reform. 151 Brigade was the first brigade to come forward, then the 69th Brigade came, and then we'd lost the 150, we were always given some other formation to make up, and in this case the 1st Greek Brigade was put into the line, and eventually we took over a central position because of this. It was not a vital piece of ground, and it was fairly plain that either attacks would come in the northern sector or as a hook around the south, and that these were the main ways to try and come into the actual line itself.
So there you were. What happened next?
Well, we had a steady period of contact. The lines weren't very close in our area, and most of the ground was not observable. There was a big depression on our left called the Munasib Depression, and the enemy was completely concealed in this. 169 Brigade was on the south of the 151 Brigade, and they, in fact, when they were called forward, had several attacks of different sorts, both before the Battle of Alamein and during the Battle of Alamein. And they found they were up against an Italian division called Folgore. Nobody knew much about these, but they turned out, in fact, to be an Italian parachutist division who fought very well indeed. And really, both in the run-up to Alamein and during the Battle of Alamein, we didn't get much change out of the attacks put in on these positions. They were unobservable, being in this depression, and very difficult people to deal with.
So what happened next? Did you take part in the actual battle as a unit, providing covering as part of the bombardment, or were you still really in reserve?
When the Battle of Alamein eventually started, which was 22nd, 23rd October, I think I'm right in saying, the main attack was launched in the north. A subsidiary attack was put in at the south, but with the main intention of keeping that one of the German armoured divisions engaged and not able to move immediately to confront the main attack. These attacks went in, but the ground was very difficult and they didn't make very much progress. Folgore was one stumbling block, but the the country was very difficult too. The going was very difficult. We supported all these attacks, and we did a lot of counter-battery work. Because of the nature of the line, the OP positions were mostly on forward slopes on our side, which was... We had one regimental OP, which we manned, and a high point, a slightly high point, called Alam Nail, N-A-Y-I-L. And this could only be occupied at night and didn't have very much observation over enemy positions. It was quite a wide gap. And this duty was carried out regularly, but the position was well known and was shelled frequently by the enemy. And Captain Hamilton was quite severely wounded on one occasion when he was manning the OP and couldn't, of course, be evacuated until after dark.
Did you take it in turns, or was it just the OP officers that would do this? I mean, you were a command post officer.
Yes, I was a senior lieutenant by this time. And what we did quite a lot of was to keep bringing the guns forward to temporary positions after dark and firing from them so that we didn't get our main battle positions located. And it was my job as the command post officer to choose these positions, survey them roughly, and then connect the two troops together for that firing. We did quite a lot of counter-battery firing as well.
What would you look for, in a temporary gun position? What would make a good one?
Well, the choice was anywhere. The ground was quite flat, and... one simply chose a position to get the range right, probably move up to perhaps 2,000 yards from the FDLs, and fire in that position, and then go back to our battle positions, which might be 4,000 or 5,000 yards.
Would you actually dig in on the temporary gun position, or just be stood on the flat sand or earth?
We didn't dig in.
Now, what about your main gun positions? What could you describe them, the sort of layout of your gun positions at that time?
Well, you've got to... the troops, the guns would be perhaps 25 yards apart in a rough sort of hoop. You had tannoy connection from the gun position officer's control post, so that he could give orders to the guns direct, and the numbers one could reply on the tannoy to him. So a gun position would probably cover perhaps 100 yards, 120 yards.
Now, what about the individual gun pits? Would they actually be dug in or sandbagged up?
We dug in and sandbagged as we could according to the ground. But you had to be able to still have a level position over the top of the wall of the gun pit to engage direct fire if you were attacked by tanks.
Now, what about your command post? Can you describe what it would be like? I mean, what would it be?
Well, ours is a bit more complicated because we had to have two or three assistants who worked various things out and have artillery boards deployed. But so it was just a larger hole in the ground, probably with a bend in it, because if one end was hit, the other end might be all right. And one worked out various things. We used to get a meteor telegram each day, and there were various ways of working out the adjustments for the wind speed and direction, which was done. It was a marvellous thing called the BC's rule, and one or two assistants mastered the ability to work out this, which was putting these adjustments in from the meteor telegram. quite frankly, I never understood it myself.
Right, fair. I won't ask you about that then. It's all fair. So this was the battery command post. That's not the troop command post. And the artillery board, in your notes, you've got quite a description of it. It's from a little bit earlier, but do you remember much about it? Or was that, again, do you still remember how it worked, or...?
I do, but you had a cover, a special cover fastened to this board on which you plotted in one position your gun position. You had a steel arm and a steel arc which you could then fit over this plotting and swing to anywhere on the board, which is a replica of the ground and the map and the ground you're fighting over, so that you could engage a target at very short notice, work out the angle for the guns and the range.
This was all part of the quick method of dropping into action.
Exactly. And it was very interesting when we were at Gazala. We only had two covers, I think, spare. And by the time we'd finished in that position, we'd plotted positions round over 270 degrees, firing behind us and all over the place.
I just thought we'd drop that in, because I knew you remembered some about that. So, we had the temporary gun positions, you've got the main gun positions, you weren't there much longer before you fell ill, or rather you were certainly taken off for hospital. Is there anything else before we go on to that?
The main action by the division was the 151 Brigade, who were sent to the north as infantry were... new infantry were required, and put in and took part in the Operation Supercharge, and gained all their objectives in conjunction with 152nd Brigade from the Highland Division.
Now that was on November, looks like 1st, the night of November the 1st. Now, were you involved in providing backing artillery for this?
We weren't allowed to move north at all, and we actually had one night when we had no infantry in front of us in the line, and I spent the night with Major George Leslie Wood of the 6DLI, and we shared a bottle of whiskey during the night. We had two small patrols of gunners in the line, and we knew that the Free French Brigade was going to move into this position in the morning. But that was all that was in the line for that night.
Pretty vulnerable, then.
Well, it was a reasonable guess. I enjoyed the company of very well-known officer of the 6, George Leslie, and he later commanded the 6DLI in Normandy.
Now,
in the morning, the Free French turned up, drove their vehicles onto the positions, which normally would have drawn enemy fire, but by this time the enemy was already beginning to pull out, although the Italian troops, with little transport, could only just pull back a short way. And that really was the end of any active engagement.
Now, what happened to you then? Why were you hospitalised?
Well, there were various complaints that you got in the desert from time to time, and sandfly fever was one, and in fact, jaundice was another. I suppose 25 to 30% of people contracted this, and eventually I had contracted it just at the end of the battle. As we were out of action, Bill Cheeseman said, "You're going back to get this dealt with." So I was evacuated.
Now, you just had jaundice. You didn't have sandfly fever as well, or was it?
No. I just had jaundice. And I went back to a base hospital near Geneva on the canal and was there for a fortnight. Just as I was leaving the troop position, Bill Cheeseman told me, because there'd been a vacancy for a captain, he had put my name forward and I could put up three popes as this was now authorized. I knew that if you were away from the unit 3 weeks, you would lose any temporary rank. But I put my I bought the captain's slip-ons and put them up, and did the fortnight's course at the Geneva Hospital. Then I asked to go back to the regiment, but they insisted that I couldn't do this. I would have to go to a rest camp, and this would be for a fortnight. So I was sent to a rest camp on the coast, very, very close to the Palestine-Egyptian border, and spent a fortnight there, rather disgruntled, because I knew I'd would lose my rank when I got back to the regiment. After the fortnight was up, I went back to Cairo by train, and back to the base camp, and from the base camp, Al-Maza at Cairo, and then I asked permission to rejoin my unit, and was given this, and started up the long, slow chain of supply, which was the way you had to go to get back to the regiment. The front line at this time was moving into across the Libyan border into Tripolitania.
This would be December, would it? Before Christmas, you get back?
After Christmas.
January. Then.
January, yes. January. And it took quite a long time with train to so far. Railhead, I think, had reached the Libyan-Egyptian border. But from there on, it was convoys. And I found out that my regiment was at Benghazi area, and located near the airfield there of Benina, and out of action. I eventually joined them in January and was sent as a gun position officer, as a lieutenant, to 296 Battery, with still Guy Fawkes commanding.
So you'd lost your promotion.
That's right.
How did you feel about this loss of promotion? Because it just seems a bit hard, really.
Well, I think that's just, you've got to get on with the job. The people at the sharp end, they can't afford not to have somebody there and doing the job. The person doing the job has the rank. It was the rules, anyway.
So you accepted it?
Oh, yes.
Now, you were saying, why were you not sent back to your old battery? I mean, I know you keep changing battery, but this is another change. I wondered why they changed.
This is wartime. You've got to get on with it. Somebody's got to do the job. I mean, it's impractical.
Now, what was the situation and state of the unit when you rejoined them?
The position was that all three-ton transport had been taken away because the supply line was so long and was working under army control. The regiment was stranded in this position for the time being, and we had to look after ourselves. It was very rocky ground, and rather strange period of the year, and mushrooms appeared quite frequently in the month of January and February. And then you came later on to another period of March when you got a flowering of the desert. This really we experienced mainly before Ghazala, but I mention it at this particular phase. And it was as though somebody had taken a dozen packets of annual seed and spread them broadcast, and little things like mignonette and flax and sweet smelling, very strong, and the desert actually bloomed. Very interesting. I remember doing a mine course.
Tell me about that. What do you remember?
Well, we were explained mines, the Teller mine and the S mine, And later, when I came back to the battery, I had to instruct our people, because everybody now had the responsibility of being able to probe for mines and clear minefields if they had to. It could not be simply a task left for the engineers. And I had a group of people around me one day explaining the mines, and I had an S mine which has three small inserts in which the detonators are put, and then there is usually a three-pronged main detonator on top of it. I had removed the three other charges, but I was saying, now this is how it works, here you are, and with my bayonet I touched the three-pronged thing on top of the mine, which then exploded and went straight up in the air about 100 feet, and when I looked around there was nobody near me with 50 yards. I had forgotten the lifting charge, which is in fact in the bottom of the S mine, and chucked it up to the height it did. We were all rather mine conscious at the time, and Guy Fawkes, the battery commander, was a thorough nuisance, because he would mine the entrance to the... He'd attach a tripwire to the entrance to the officer's mess tent or whatever, and this sort of thing. However, we were very mine conscious. The other thing that happened, which was really rather unpleasant, was the Italian troops had defensive positions dug in round Bonino airfield, and we were on this piece of ground, and unfortunately they were not very clean people, and quite a lot of us got lousy as a result of this. In fact, about 30%, including myself.
Was this the first time that lice had been a problem in the desert?
Well, it was the first time I'd experienced it.
How bad was it for you anyway?
Well, it was just awkward, and they arranged to go down to the field dressing station, and there you had to be completely shaved and ointment put on and your underclothes destroyed. So it was rather a personal inconvenience.
Did you have any problem with desert sores? I mean, perhaps, I mean, at any time in the desert, because it was a real problem, possibly through the diet, but...
I'm glad you raised that point. It certainly was a problem. When we were at Gazala in the line there, we were all pretty well okay. It was a good desert. When we got back to Alamein, it was a different story, and the desert sores would start quite easily from just a cut. But about this, also after Alamein, or at the time of the end of about Alamein, they've had a solution for it, and they brought in a very strong purple dye thing, which you painted on.
How bad did they get before that? I mean,
they were just a nuisance, really. It depended. If you're not in action, you could wash and look after yourself, but they just wouldn't heal. They wouldn't clear up.